We're live.
All right. We're up and we are running here. Welcome to Chicago Jazz Revealed. Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com. I am, man, we had quite a morning here at the beautiful offices of Chicago Jazz Magazine. And then Andy and I, Shum, who we're going to bring on in a second, had a little Skype snafu. So that's why I'm about 5 minutes late. But hey, it's jazz time, right? So who cares? Whatever. All right, so a couple of things coming up. What a beautiful day out today. Unbelievable. I went running this morning. If anybody wants to see some of my crazy banter or any of that stuff outside of the show, feel free to tune in to my Instagram, which is MikeJeffers237. That's on IG, Instagram, 237, the number of, in the hotel room in The Shining, my favorite number. Kind of weird. Well, someday somebody will interview me and I've got a whole bunch of stuff that we can talk about, but we're not interviewing me. We're interviewing Andy Shum today. So we're going to bring him on in a second. What a great day. If you get a chance to go out, social isolate and go wander around by yourself, today's the day to do it. It is gorgeous. The sun was out, ran down to the lake and back today. Gorgeous, gorgeous, incredible. So get out and enjoy yourself. Just do it by yourself, please. Other things, obviously, staying away from everyone, but also now we're in the mask era of this entire situation. So I went out yesterday, had a mask on, in and out of the stores, trying to limit myself to doing that. So be sure to do the same. It looks pretty incredible. I ran right down Michigan Avenue this morning, and there was nobody on Michigan Avenue. If you look at my Instagram account on my stories or on my Facebook stories, my personal page, Mike Jeffers. I don't post this stuff on Chicago Jazz Magazine, but I literally ran down Michigan Avenue and I felt like this is how the guys that lead the marathon, you know, this is how these guys do it, because it was no cars, no anything, cranking straight along. So anyways, all right, I digress. That's my morning. Sent out a couple of emails. Of course, I'm the director of programming and entertainment at the Epiphany Center for the Arts down there in the corner. And we are going to be opening up. We were going to open up April 30th, but now, obviously, with all of the COVID-19 situation, we're pushing it. So I will definitely let you know what's happening. But for those of you that are not familiar with the Epiphany Center for the Arts, it's right in the West Loop. Visit epiphanyshy.com. There's three different venues there. One is the old church that holds 1,000 people for concerts. Then we're going to have the sanctuary, which is on the second floor, an old chapel from 1885. Incredible acoustics in both. We're going to be doing 7 nights a week music up there, music series, all genres. I'm going to be programming that. So if you have some ideas, some different things, from, you know, any genre of music, hit me up, leave me a comment. Tracy Oliver, he's already on. I love it. Perfect. And I'm assuming all the audio works, because if it doesn't, usually I start getting text messages and getting phone calls. So everything's cool. And if you hear anything strange, let me know. I'll try to adjust it. Again, I have to preface this entire situation. I'm running the board myself. I'm shooting this myself. We are self-sufficient over here. So when things screw up, it's my fault, as what happened when I tried to bring Andy on originally. So stand by. We've got two announcements. First announcement, a Q&A live stream. University of Chicago presents, they had to cancel the rest of their jazz series for 2020, unfortunately, right? I think that was two more concerts coming up. But this Friday at 7 p.m., a Q&A live with Melissa Alden, Aldana. She's going to be doing a special Q&A live on Facebook. So if you go to the University of Chicago Presents Facebook page, you can check that out and ask questions. Also on that broadcast is going to be Sam Harris, Joel Ross from Chicago, Great Vibus, and a few other people. So be sure to tune in. We'll hit that up, and we're going to post that on Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and all those other great spots. So that's the first one. The second one is big news. I'm going to be on WGN Radio Saturday morning, 6 a.m. with my buddy Mike Steven. He has a show on there called Outside the Loop, episode 704. So he's got me beat by a few. I'm going to be on there. We talked yesterday. We're going to have the interview on. We're going to talk about this live show I'm doing, Chicago Music Revealed, and also about the Epiphany Center for the Arts. that I'm involved with that's opening up, as I mentioned, and Chicago Jazz Magazine and a whole lot more. So tune in to Mike's show. That's 6 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Saturday morning, WGN, 7:20 a.m. And this Saturday, you will hear yours truly talking about this live streaming show that we're doing right now. So, all right, if you like this show, leave a comment, give me a thumbs up, share it along to your friends. We're trying to connect the entire music community through this show in Chicago while we're under this incredible distress. So let's make it happen. The other thing that I always mention, we have a lot of GoFundMes and a lot of relief funds are listed on ChicagoJazz.com. We've got a few more that we need to add today. So, of course, support all of the clubs, all the musicians. Nobody is working right now. It's not happening in the music scene, in the entertainment scene. So support as much as you can. Buy a CD, buy a recording, check out their live streams. A lot of people are doing Facebook live streams. And I'm going to segue that right into Andy Shum, who I'm going to bring on now. And he is on the Skype line. There he is. Hey, Andy, how are you?
Hi, Mike.
Man, it's great to have you on. And I know, you know, you and I first met. I mean, obviously, I've seen your name all over the place. It's just, you know what happens when musicians that are working in Chicago work all the time, they never get to connect and and hang out, right? So, I mean, that's kind of the nature of the beast. But you and I met at the Jazz Fest, and we've been threatening to actually talk and do an interview. And unfortunately, we're not in person right now, but the second best thing, we're on Skype, and you're on Chicago Music Revealed, and I'm glad you were able to hang this morning for a few minutes.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. Fun opportunity. Thanks for doing it.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. It's a pleasure to have you on. Now the one thing that I want to find out, and why don't we talk specifically, because you know, you're just known for in the trad jazz community, Fat Babies, Chicago Cellar Boys. You play all over the place, a lot of regular steady gigs when there's actually regular steady gigs.
Right.
But let's talk real fast before we get into all of that about the live streaming stuff you've been doing, and you've been doing it with piano, right?
Right.
I mean, I always associate you playing cornet, trumpet, but you play a killer piano too. So why don't you talk a little bit? When's the next live stream? When can people check you out? Where can people check you out? Facebook Live, I assume. So fill us in on that, and then we'll deep dive on you.
Yeah. So we've been doing it every Saturday at 8 p.m. just in my basement, which is probably the only safe place to be. and it's just on my personal Facebook page, which is, let's see, I wrote it down because I'm not so good with that. Just facebook.com/Andy.Shum.
Okay.
Andy.Shum. And 8 p.m. And it's been, I'm fortunate to play the piano so I can play by myself, not just the cornet. It's a little strange just playing some Arbenz by yourself.
It'd be almost like myself just playing solo drums for like
right.
an hour. That wouldn't attract a lot of people.
Yeah.
So you're doing it. So when's the next one you're doing? Because I'm listening to you, and of course I'm not paying attention to write it down. So give it to me one more time.
Yeah, it's this Saturday at 8 p.m.
Okay.
And hopefully every Saturday until this is over.
Yeah, and hopefully there won't be that many Saturdays, right?
I hope so.
Get back in the clubs. Now you've been, I mean, so let's talk a little bit, because reading up on your bio, are you from Milwaukee originally? Is that how you ended up in Chicago?
Yeah, just outside of Milwaukee. Yeah. And Chicago's just so close and such a big place to play. It was easy.
What's the, so let's talk a little bit about your background, because I mean, you're associated, at least in my world here in Chicago Jazz Magazine world, in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, trad jazz scene. I mean, you're like you're in every band that I see playing all over the place and all these different things. Well, did you grow up listening to that? Did your parents have that on all the time? I mean, what was your association with that?
Well, I always tell people that people like me, whatever I'm like, there's some seed planted early. You're not quite sure what that is. For me, a big thing was hearing a Dixieland band when I was in high school. And that first night I went and I sat in, and that was, I would say the room turned upside down. It was just so exciting.
Wow.
First time playing cornet or trumpet in public, you know, not in high school, something like that.
So, I mean,
it was exciting.
So you grew up listening to that? I mean, was it around you, like your parents listened to it, or?
No, it wasn't around in the house or anything like that. This is kind of pre-internet. I didn't know how to find anything like that, you know. I think I started playing jazz because I knew it was called jazz. And so my parents got me jazz lessons. So I went down a hard bop path for about 10 years before I realized that wasn't what I was really into.
And what drew you to the trad jazz? I mean, because, you know, when you're playing, all right, so let's say you get into hard bop, right? I mean, that's pretty grooving. It's straight ahead. A lot of notes, a lot of stuff happening, probably led you in to some, you know, obviously, you know, Miles Davis, and then pushing you maybe into Miles, and maybe you even heard some of the, you know, more electric Miles or more electric tunes and stuff like that. But to go from there, especially at your age, I can't imagine they were playing traditional jazz at any of the dances you went to in high school. So then you went backwards,
well,
right?
My buddies were all the old guys, you know.
Okay.
I played some banjo and stuff like that. And one of the major attractions was I was working immediately. There just weren't many guys doing it. So I played some banjo, some cornet, and that's it. You know, I liked making money to start with. Then I found I really liked it when I heard the records.
That's pretty interesting. So you ended up getting it. So you found your calling in the Dixieland traditional jazz music. Obviously, Bix Beiderbecke, right? Probably had to be one of your heroes, and is somebody that you've followed and studied. And I know from watching some of the YouTube stuff you've done and everything else, you do a lot of arranging too, right? And you got into arranging and composing, I assume.
Yes. Yep. I always liked the idea of bringing the arrangement back to the small group, which has been kind of lost in jazz in the last 80, 90 years. And that was, I don't think I can find a single record from the 20s, maybe a couple, but they all have an arrangement, some arrangement. And I think that's a missing piece, and I'd like to bring that back.
You know, you're right, because, I mean, really what happens? They play the head a lot of times. I mean, in regular, you know, if you're playing a jazz gig, you're at Andy's or something, you know, play the head, and then everybody takes solos, and then you play the head, and you're done. But you're right, because a lot of those older arrangements, the stock arrangements that are still, you know, here, there, and around, they're completely arranged out, right? I mean, there's a little, they open it up a little bit, but it's opened up specifically within the format of the tune, correct?
Right. Yeah, it's one of the biggest mindset shifts I've had to make from playing more modern music to older music, is that it's really not about stretching out, but it is about improvising. It's a nice mix. That's one thing that appeals to me. I would say there's three types of musicians from the 20s, say horn players, trumpet players. Everybody would be able to just read the stock arrangement and would just say solo. Good, read it. The second level would be most of the guys they'd read that, but they could syncopate it, put a little heat onto it. And then the third level would be the Bix Beiderbecke, the Red Nichols, the Louis Armstrong, who could go all the way with it.
Yeah, and really branch out, right? Really extend out and really branch out on the whole thing.
Exactly.
I mean, so back then, back in the 20s, back in the 30s, what I'm hearing from you and also some of the stuff that I studied, I mean, a lot of those guys were beyond accomplished musicians, but the improvisation part of it wasn't quite there yet for a lot of them, right? So it was kind of a rare breed that could really blow, like Bix or like Louis, right?
Right, and that was... You know, I always say, they say call it the jazz age. You can call it that, but jazz has always been underground. Guys like Louis and Bix have always been underground. They were never the headliners, not in those days. Mm-hmm. That was just more of an inside circle club thing.
So it's interesting. I mean, you know, because I live in Bridgeport, right? So right down the street is the old Sunset Gardens right on 35th Street.
Right.
And it was the old hardware store forever. And now they've opened it up and you can see the old mural on the back wall back there. Have you ever been down to this area to check out some of these old ballrooms and some of the old spaces that used to be? Because that was like a real underground space back in the 20s and 30s, I think.
Yep.
I mean, and that whole area in Chicago, the Southside Bronzeville area, just, you would never know it now, but walking around down there, apparently there was tons of live music, and it was all kind of underground unless you knew where to go, right?
That's right. Well, you know, it was very popular, but musicians loved to just hang out at other clubs, that kind of thing, jam sessions all night. I have a little secret about the Sunset Cafe when it was the hardware store, the Ace Hardware store.
Yep.
That's where I bought all my plungers for my trumpet because I thought that's kind of appropriate.
Oh, that's great. That's cool, man. Well, and now it's a beauty shop now, but what they did was they ripped down. He had like half of the mural. It was upstairs.
Right.
They ripped the whole thing down. You can see the whole thing now on the back.
Really?
Wall.
No kidding. I'll check that out.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, It's really unbelievable. I mean, you know, but there's so many of those places around. But it's interesting because I never thought of how, you know, because you see the big pictures and everybody's crowded in the place, but really you're right. It's always been kind of an underground thing, and then it materializes, and then it transforms to the next level and the next level and the next level. Now, with you, let's talk a little bit. So you came to Chicago. How old were you when you came to Chicago?
Well, let's see. I came, it was 10 years ago in January, I believe. So I was 24.
Okay. So how did you first connect into the scene? Because there's only, I mean, back then, there wasn't really a lot of trad jazz. I mean, there was some, right? But there wasn't like the Fat Babies were not playing every Tuesday at the Mill. You know, I mean, it was a whole different scene happening. So how did you connect into that scene, make it affordable economically for you to be here in Chicago and then grow it from there?
Well, I moved here because I was actually working quite a bit, but not much in the city, more suburban kind of things. And I was with a band called the West End Jazz Band, which is a great band, six piece, hot dance, hot jazz, 20 stuff. Mm-hmm. And I actually moved to Chicago as a drummer with that band, which is kind of strange.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. I don't know how good I am anymore, but I used to play with those guys. And then I played with the Salty Dogs quite a bit.
Okay. Yep.
Which has been around since the 40s. And there was a scene of older middle-aged musicians, and I still play with those who are left. And that was quite the training ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what kind of gigs were they doing? I mean, obviously the Ileana Jazz Society and Chicago Jazz Magazine works with them a lot to promote their gigs and things like that. So I know them, and they do a great monthly traditional series. It's one of the only ones I know of that's so established and successful, and they get a great crowd, really good followers out there. But I mean, outside of that, what other spots were there at the time? Because now, you know, now it really opened up. I mean, there's a lot of different places looking to bring in those types of groups because it knows it appeals to a certain audience. And actually the audience is on the younger side now, which is amazing to me too. But back then, where were you kind of playing around?
Well, let's see. I used to play out in St. Charles at this place called Al Capone's Hideaway, for one, on the Fox River. I used to play with West End Jazz Band. It was out at the Milk Pail out in Elgin.
Oh, yeah.
There's brunches on Sunday mornings. And sometimes you play at the Village Tavern in Long Grove. So basically places that were, you know, middle-aged or retired folks used to, you know, frequent. And it kind of makes sense because those folks used to live in the city maybe, and they went here to Andy's and Mill and all that stuff. But then, well, I live out here now, so I'm going to bring people I like to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of makes sense. I think that's one reason I caught the end of that wave, and now we're on to another wave of, you know, city-based fans.
Well, talk a little bit about, I mean, I feel like you and a couple of the other guys, specifically in the Fat Babies, because that's the one band that I saw really branch over and start to bring in the younger crowd. But also you guys had steady gigs,
right?
Like, you know, happening, and that really helped. And then obviously Delmark Records got involved and had you guys record, you know, on Delmark a little bit, and Bob Kester pushed it out and stuff.
Right.
But I mean, what was that? So how did you meet those like-minded guys that were around your age? And then what was the thought process to start playing this stuff? Is it just out of the love of the music? Obviously, you know, that's the first thing. Yep. But like, then to be able to pitch it to clubs back then, I mean, 10 years ago, if you walked into a club, you said, hey, I've got like a, you know, 8 to 10 piece band and I want to play on a, you know, Saturday night at 8 o'clock. And we're, you know, the guy would be like, are you playing in a rock band or something? I mean, what are you going to do here?
Know.
So, I mean, what was that first point where you were like, hey, this is pretty cool. I think we're starting to really make something happen here.
Boy, it happened quickly, but it almost happened under the radar for me. Just woke up one day and realized this was happening.
Mm-hmm.
I never played for a younger audience before that. I hate to say this, but I think it's true. And it's one reason you have to take advantage of this. Younger people like to be around younger people. So it's unfortunate in a lot of ways. It's fortunate in other ways. Mm-hmm. But that was a big thing. It was a younger-ish band. That helped a lot to get a toehold into that. As far as how the band got together and how we met, I knew the clarinet player and the trombone player for many years. And I met Bo Sample at the Green Mill. And he always wanted to do a more jazz band as opposed to rockabilly or rock and roll or blues. So he said, well, bring your guys and I'll bring my guys. And we'll see what happens. That's all it was. And what's strange to think about that now is I had a complete career before Fat Babies. In my mind, it's still kind of new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Well, what's it been now? 10 years? Is that about right?
It's about 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah. And how many albums do you guys have?
Let's see. We have 3 on Delmark and we have 2 on Rivermont under Paul Asaro's name, our piano player. One's a Jellero Morton record and one's a Fats Waller record. So 5.
So when you guys started doing it, obviously, I'm assuming you were probably playing, you know, a lot of the old tunes, right? I mean, you're playing the arrangements because you had them and all that stuff. But when you got into composing and arranging your own stuff, because I know you guys do that. What's the thought process? Is it just because it comes naturally out of you that you're like, oh, yeah, okay, no problem. I'm going to write this. But then it sounds like it's from the 1920s or 30s or does it? I mean, you know the nuances more than, a lot of us. So, I mean, are you kind of bringing the 20s and 30s into the 2000s with some of the composing and some of the arranging that you're doing? Or are you traditional style and just sticking in that era?
Yeah. Well, I always say our book, I've mostly put together, but we've had help from all the guys in the band, but typically it's half, arrangements that I've taken off of records from the 20s or 30s, and about half are completely new arrangements on old tunes, and then some compositions sprinkled in. I don't necessarily try to update, but I try to innovate within that box. And more important than anything else, I try to write for the guys in the band. Because that's what those guys did in those days. And arrangements in 1925 were disposable. They lasted 3 weeks and they're in the garbage. Really? They didn't last long.
Why was that? Just because they would play them in front of the same audience and they'd have to just bail out and get new ones? Or
no, it was more that songs were not popular that long. There were so many songs being written that the audience would want to hear the new song of the week. And that would be out of fashion by the end of the month.
So I can't even imagine that. Can you imagine that now? It'd be like,
I know.
So that's interesting. Wow. I never even thought about that.
It was all amazing. Commercial.
So really the tunes that really stuck had to be really well done and really, people wanted to hear them over and over and over, because otherwise a lot of these tunes that we know of, there's probably hundreds of tunes that were probably comparable, but the composer, the arranger just bailed out on it, right?
Yeah, thousands of them. Well, there's kind of 2 tunes that survived. One would be the jazz tunes. Jellero Morton wrote this, and the guys like to play that in the jam sessions after hours. And that kind of, those always stuck around. They maybe never got popular. The other kind are the pop tunes, which is mostly what we play these days. Everybody, when you're playing standards, things like that, those things kind of disappeared in the end of the 20s, and they reappeared in the 40s and 50s. Because the older folks were buying records or that kind of nostalgia.
Yep.
So those things disappeared in the 30s, typically.
That's amazing, man. That's wild. I mean,
some songs, I'm not even sure why they got popular. Like, for example, the tune Chicago, that everybody plays, State Street, all that stuff. That was recorded, I think, in 1922 or 3, pretty early, was not a hit. And then all of a sudden in the 50s, there it is. I don't know.
Well, I'll bet you that if somebody went back and pulled some of those tunes out, there's probably a lot of tunes back then that people would dig now.
Yes.
And especially if you rearrange it a certain way or do something and it changes it just slightly and everybody would go bananas about it. But the fact that those tunes would only last like 3 or 4 weeks and then they're out of there, and then the fact that these guys were playing like 2, 3, 4 hours at night, right? I mean, that's the deal. Just it's mind-boggling to think about how many tunes that were written back then.
Oh, it's ridiculous. I've got a friend who in New York. He's a Vince Giordano. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Sure,
he's a guy who did music for Boardwalk Empire, and he's the most prolific collector of sheet music and stock arrangements I've ever known, probably in the world. And he's made a list of how many of these arrangements exist, stock arrangements. It's about 40,000 between 1900 and 1940, and he's missing less than 100 of them.
Wow.
And so there's more than you can ever even know.
Oh, my God. So yep. do you ever go, like, you know, I interviewed Alan Gresick for one of the features, and he goes to the library, he goes to the Harold Washington Library, where they apparently have a massive collection of stock arrangements, and he files through. Do you ever go down there and look through things down there? I mean, where do you even come up with getting some of these stock arrangements for your own purposes?
Well, you can still find them on the loose, sometimes on eBay, but I do go to the library sometimes. However, right over here, I've got filing cabinets full of them. So,
I
got my own
library. I wondered what that was. I was watching one of your live streams. I'm like, man, he's got a lot of filing cabinets over there.
Yeah, I need more already.
So, I mean, these are all stuff that you can buy on eBay. Maybe you go looking in an old antique store or something, and here they are. And, you know, and we should tell everybody, why don't you explain what a stock arrangement is? And also, why don't you explain a little bit about the instrumentation in one of these traditional bands? Because it's different than, like, looking at a Count Basie band. It's a little bit different setup.
Yeah. So a stock arrangement from the 20s is typically a 10-piece. So that's three brass, three saxophones, and then full rhythm. So piano, banjo, tuba, drums, or some variation of that. And the stock arrangements are just something you go to the music store and pick it up for a buck and a quarter, and it'd be one of those songs that's popular for 3 weeks. So your band can out and play it that night. They're typically not that interesting musically. There may be some good spots, but they're just made for you to get the band playing the song. So typically a band in the 20s would take that and they'd doctor it. They call it doctoring it. You put a solo in, put the vocal in, eliminate one of the choruses, write a new intro, new ending, and you'd be done. You know, that's how you do it. So Fat Babies were a 7 or 8 piece band, which is smaller than that, 3 horns or 4 horns, and Cellar Boys were 2 or 3 horns. So basically they're more or less ineffective for a smaller band, but with Fat Babies with the 4 horns, they do work. I can rearrange them and they sound pretty good.
You know, so let's talk about the groups now. Okay, so the Fat Babies, a lot of people know the Fat Babies. I know I'm going to get in an email or I'm going to get in a comment in like 10 hours. Why the name the Fat Babies? I remember asking Bo about it, and when I did a podcast interview with him last year. But why don't you tell us, why is it called the Fat Babies?
Well, first and foremost, we didn't know if the band was going to last. So the first gig, you make up a name and, oh my God, the band's taken off. I guess we got to keep it. No, but really, Bo Sample remembers a saying from when he grew up in Texas where it'd be so hot outside, you know. And we always called the music, you know, hot music. Mm-hmm. And it'd be so hot out, it's hotter than a fat baby. So that's all it is. Yeah.
Well, and not only that, but, you know, obviously, as we talk, we know that this all accidentally kind of happened because you couldn't believe it. But I mean, what better hip name could you come up with, like Fat Baby, to appeal to like a 20-something audience, like at the honky tonk when everybody kind of wants to dress up in retro and pound shots and drink Manhattans and old style beer, right? I mean, it's the Fat Babies. It's like done.
I know. It's great. It worked out great. I mean, you can't plan that.
No. Now, the Chicago Cellar Boys, that's did you start that group yourself?
I did. Yeah. The way that came about is Fat Babies had been playing at Honky Tonk Barbecue every Sunday since I think 2010. Mm-hmm. I believe 2010 or 2011. I have to look in my books. But Bo Sample and Alex Hall, the drummer and the bass player, due to family stuff and other obligations, they decided not to play there on Sundays anymore. So we don't lose the gig. So we reformed and made something different out of it.
Okay.
I never intended to, but it worked out that way.
It's another a lucky move.
Yeah, it worked out well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and now, so the Fat Babies are at the Mill, obviously, when the Mill is open, when every venue is open on Tuesdays. And you're with them, but then also the Chicago Cellar Boys, I see you performing all over. I know you've been at Winters, you do different hits. You're on Sundays over at Honky Tonk when Honky Tonk's open?
Yep, 8 to 11 Sunday.
What size band is that?
Well, it just started with the guys that were left over from Fat Babies. So Fat Babies were a 7-piece band at that time. Mm-hmm. So I play trumpet. We have a clarinet player, reed player, banjo, piano, and then our trombone player, Dave Bach, he switched to sousaphone, which is his main instrument.
Okay.
So we just went with a 5-piece band, and we did that started in October of 2017. And just recently, 6 months ago, I've been trying to book it as a 6-piece band with 3 horns. So I play trumpet and reeds, and then we have two other reed players, alto and tenor.
Well, and also you yourself, you get hired by a lot of other bands throughout the country, because I know that you do some of those Bix Fests up in Wisconsin and in Iowa. I think have you been out to the Iowa one too? Talk a little bit about Bix Beiderbecke, because he die when he was 27, right? But he left this musical legacy behind him that's lived on for what, almost 100 years now, right?
Yeah, he died when he was 28. He was born in 03 and died in 31.
Wow.
And he didn't make any records in 1931, so pretty much inactive, unfortunately. But he was, I always say he's the first repertory jazz musician. He was the first important jazz musician to get to start playing jazz because of records. You know, take Louis Armstrong, born in 1901. He learned jazz because he played with the old time guys. Bix heard records. So he's important because of that. So whenever he's recording under his own name, he's recording original Dixieland jazz band things, but putting his own twist on them. He's the first modern jazz player in a lot of ways.
Because he used to improvise around on stuff and also add his own twist to it, right? And a lot of guys back then just played it straight ahead, just read the notes on the page. Is that right?
Well, more or less. But I guess what I'm saying is that Bix was the first guy. He was playing tunes that were 10 years old on record. That never happened.
You know?
So that was, he was innovating on an old framework, which is what we do now. You know, it's a very modern mentality.
Why do you think he stuck around? And I mean, people literally, you know, obviously, you know, they'll mention Miles, they'll mention Dizzy, they'll mention Wynton Marsalis, and then Bix Beiderbecke. I mean, Bix is in these conversations, and it's almost over 100 years ago that he was around.
It's just permanently modern in a lot of ways, and he's one of those guys where if we didn't have him, just say we don't have any evidence of him playing, nothing like that. He's so far ahead of many other cornet players. We wouldn't know what the instrument could even do. It's that important. He's so far ahead. But I think the real lesson of Bix is that he had the kind of perfect pitch where he could be drunk on the couch and the guys would be a party trick, and Joe Venuti would come and smash all the keys down, and he'd say, "All right, name them," and he could go left to right, name all the notes. Right? One of those guys. But the lesson is that he could do that. He had limitless musical ability and did not use it all ever. That's an important lesson. And I think the restraint he used is incredible.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. That's actually like half the battle, right? Is when you have tons of chops, tons of ability, but then you know how to use it tastefully and within the context of what music is.
I would assume so, but I might not know that.
Let's assume you do. Well, all right. So everybody, this Saturday, 8 p.m. and every Saturday after that, right, for the live stream, Andy Shum, right on his Facebook page. We'll link it up too. We'll leave a link, and we'll also we'll cross post it once he goes live, if we can catch it. If not, we'll push it back out onto Chicago Jazz Magazine. And hopefully, Andy, once things calm down and everything gets back to normal, you'll be back at the Honky Tonk right here in Pilsen on Sundays with the Chicago Cellar Boys, and then on Tuesdays with the Fat Babies. Is there any other studies that I'm missing out on?
Yeah, there's one that's kind of a little more off the beaten path. It is at Honky Tonk, but it's every Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m., and that's either a duo or a trio, Blue 2 or Blue 3. And I play piano, and our banjo player, Johnny Donatowitz, plays banjo and the tenor guitar. So that's kind of a neat, more intimate dinner time kind of thing.
Oh, that's awesome. By the way, and everybody that's watching this, you know, everybody knows the Green Mill, Broadway and Lawrence, world famous since like 1910, 1920, used to be the Green Mill Gardens, all that stuff. You've got to go check that out. But the Honky Tonk, I think they're, about 15 years, I think they've been around right in Pilsen. Incredible award-winning barbecue, by the way, but it's really a cool vibe. You go in there, there's a big bar, there's a big area that they move tables out of the way, and you can dance in front of the stage, and it's a great cool hang in a very hip neighborhood. And if you haven't been to Pilsen, it's a great introduction. You go to Pilsen, you check out Honky Tonk, you walk down 18th Street, see everything. So it's a fun vibe, and now you know Andy's there twice a week, so you've got to stop by, say hi to him, definitely. and check everything out, because it's a very cool scene. And, you know, congratulations on all the success with all of this stuff, man. And to be able to carve out a niche in this music and to be able to push this music and reach such a wider market and wider audience and bring it to the younger music fans out there is an incredible feat. So congratulations on all your success.
Thank you. And when all this is over, I know we're going to party like it's 1933, repeal of prohibition. So come on out.
I love that. I'm going to use that. Yeah. That's it. We're going to party like it's 1933. All right. Well, hey, thanks for being on the show. And we'll link everything up. And of course, this Saturday, 8 p.m. live stream. Check it out. Kick back with a cocktail in your house. Throw up FaceTime. Throw up Facebook. And watch Andy tear up the piano and indulge yourself with some incredible music. So, all right. Thanks, Andy. Thanks for being on.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for doing it.
Definitely. All right. Well, I appreciate Andy being on, and I appreciate all of you watching. Of course, it's incredible. If you have not had a chance to check out the Fat Babies, you need to check out the Fat Babies. You need to check out the Chicago Cellar Boys. But Andy, you know, he plays with all these different groups too, because every time I get a listing, Andy's always on that listing. So he is somebody that you should go watch live, because you can't do it justice online. Although the Facebook Live thing has really taken off. I love the fact that all these different musicians are doing Facebook Live. I wanted to also mention, I mentioned it yesterday on the show, but Jeannie Tanner and Abigail Rickards are going to be doing their Desperate Times Music Series Facebook Live concert tomorrow night, Wednesday night. So you can check that out on Jeannie Tanner or Abigail Rickards Facebook page. Anybody else have Facebook? Anybody else have anything coming up live? Hit me up, leave me a comment. I want to make sure I mention it. Tomorrow we're on the show. I think we're going to have a vocalist from Brazil calling in and doing a Skype call. We've been going back and forth for like a year, and we're going to finally have her on. Guai is going to be on, I believe, from Brazil. They've got a lot of wild stuff going on in Brazil with this COVID-19 as well, so we'll check in with her on that. I believe that's going to happen tomorrow. Programming note. I've always wanted to say that. Programming note. Thursday, we're going to do a special evening show. So it's going to be about 5 or 6, because I've got conference calls going on all day for the Epiphany Center for the Arts. So Thursday, we're going to push the show. It'll be a special evening show. I will give everyone a time tomorrow, probably 5 p.m. on Thursday. But again, I love the fact that I'm getting all these comments. I'm getting all of the information sent in to me. So if you have live performances, let me know. But also, if anybody wants to do live call-in, you know, I can take phone calls. So if we want to get to the point, maybe next week, because I think I'm going to have my West Coast contributor calling in, Craig Pilo, on Friday. And I have a couple other people scheduled for Thursday already. We're going to have a whole slate of shows next week as well that I'm going to announce shortly. Really great guests. But I'm almost thinking, you know, one of these days, maybe next week, we'll do a live call-in show, because I'd love to find out what the music fans and what other musicians are doing during this time. And what better way to do it than just do a live call-in show, not knowing who's calling, where they're calling from, and what's happening. So that could get very interesting. I always loved listening to the different radio shows when they would do that. So we'll find out. But again, we're trying to connect the whole community here. Thanks for watching. I really appreciate it as usual. Thank you for bearing with me. Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and the Director of Programming at the Epiphany Center for the Arts. So stick around and watch all the other streams that are happening on Facebook today. Hopefully, I will see you back here tomorrow, 11:30 a.m. tomorrow, Wednesday. And hopefully, everyone stays safe. Everyone stays healthy. I will see you at some point on the scene in person, but until next time, hopefully I will see you at the next broadcast. See you tomorrow.